The district court, however, attributed many more counterfeit checks to Mr. Brooks in calculating the amount of loss caused by his crimes. So the question presented by Mr. Brooks's appeal is whether the district court miscalculated Mr. Brooks' advisory guideline range by attributing to him amounts of loss from counterfeit checks that the government failed to show were cashed in furtherance of activity that he jointly undertook with others and that were foreseeable to him. Now, there are quite a lot of checks, and they're a little hard to divide, so I apologize ahead of time. But I think it's most manageable if we start with the first group of checks that Mr. Brooks challenged. And those are checks that purport to be issued by a company called Relief Enterprises. First, there was no proof that Mr. Brooks cashed any of the Relief Enterprise checks. He did not plead guilty to assisting or helping to cash or conspiring to cash those checks. And the Secret Service did not interview any of the persons who were the what the government calls accomplice payees. They were the people to whom the counterfeit checks were made, and then they would go and cash them. So really, there is no one involved in cashing these checks who can identify or who did identify Mr. Brooks as an accomplice. The government's theory that Mr. Brooks was liable for the Relief Enterprises checks rests on the fact that some of the persons who cashed those checks, the accomplice payees, were also accomplice payees on another group of checks that purported to be payroll checks from the company Sonic. According to Secret Service agent Tracy Steed, who testified at sentencing, this showed that the same group was cashing Sonic and Relief Enterprise checks. But that connection between two groups of checks fails to show that it was Mr. Brooks that cashing the Relief Enterprise checks was part of the conspiracy or an act in further of the conspiracy that Mr. Brooks joined. The next set of checks are the Sonic checks that I mentioned before, and in the brief we have put two groups together, the Sonic checks and the satellite healthcare checks. Now, the Sonic payroll checks are linked to Mr. Brooks by one factor, and that is that Mr. Brooks provided a Sonic check to a person named Alex Button for him to cash that check. And that's it. All of the Sonic payroll checks, and I think there are a total of 21, they were all cashed on July 6th of 2009. That's a lot of checks for one person to go around taking his accomplices to cash. The government's Exhibit 1 begins with two spreadsheets. I think in the brief I have referred mostly to one spreadsheet, page numbered 1 through 8. Right after that page 8, there's an unnumbered page that is another spreadsheet that shows where the Sonic checks and some of the other checks were passed. By my count, it's maybe 5 or 6 different bank locations where the checks were cashed. So I think it's really impossible, extremely unlikely, for Mr. Brooks to have participated in cashing those checks. And I think there's another factor. I'm going to jump ahead, and again, I apologize. I'm trying to make it as organized as I can. But I'm going to jump ahead to some checks, a group of checks that Mr. Brooks does not dispute, and that is counterfeit checks that purported to be issued by Phil's Ice House and Amy's Ice Cream in February and March of 2011. If you look at the dates that those checks were cashed, and that appears in the government's first spreadsheet, very easy to find on top of the exhibit, they're passed over a period, maybe 2 weeks, various dates. That is much more indicative of one person cashing them. And in fact, Mr. Brooks admitted that he cashed all those checks. And when his house was searched in May of 2011, the government found check-producing equipment, check stock, a Versa check computer program, and one of the files that they found said Phil's signature. Now, the only reason I jumped ahead to that case was to try to illustrate what a check cashing scheme looks like that involves one person taking these people around, Mr. Brooks. That's what it looks like. It doesn't look like the Sonic payroll checks cashing. There is another couple of, there are another couple of checks. I've referred to them as the satellite healthcare checks that were attributed to Mr. Brooks and that were cashed in August of 2010 for about $1,800. Now, the link between Mr. Brooks and those satellite healthcare checks is that in about 3 months later, in November of 2010, Mr. Brooks was caught trying to get an accomplice, Natasha Walker, to pass one of those satellite healthcare check, not the ones that the government has attributed to him, but another check. And he also had some satellite healthcare checks in his car. That, we argue, is far too attenuated a basis to attribute to him satellite checks that were passed 3 months earlier.
Are they sequentially numbered or anything in that group?
You know, in the satellite healthcare checks?
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that, but I will after I sit down. The satellite healthcare checks, let me just take a quick look and see if I can tell you very quickly.
Well, that's okay. You can tell me later.
The two satellite healthcare checks are one number apart, the ones that are attributed to him. I don't know the numbers of the ones.
Early ones, yeah.
Yeah, those are the ones I don't know.
Do you challenge the Sonic drive-in checks?
Yes, we do.
As I understand it, they were a group of checks, all roughly maybe the same, $900 in amount that were cashed. One of the arguments about that revolves around the fact that they said both the APD checks and the Sonic checks were drawn on the same payroll account. All of the checks were cashed on a single day. The checks were drawn for an amount of $900, but the payees of the checks that were never located.
Correct.
But Brooks pleaded guilty in the state court to cashing forged Sonic checks at Guaranty Bank branches in Austin.
Well,
what's the relationship between his plea of guilty in state court and those groups of checks?
I think if I'm thinking of the same one that you're talking about, because Mr. Brooks does have a regrettable record, but it's in paragraph 50 of the pre-sentence report that talks about his pleading guilty to cashing a Sonic check. It did not seem to me from that paragraph 50 summary that it was four checks. In the pre-sentence report, it talks about what the Austin police report said, but it looks like from paragraph 50 that Mr. Brooks actually pleaded guilty to forging one check. Maybe he was helping, maybe not. Now, here is my theory, and
the quote was cashing forged payroll checks, plural. Now, I don't want to
Your Honor.
Plural, singular there.
And what are you referring to that says that?
Ma'am?
Paragraph 50.
Oh, paragraph 50. I'm
plural.
Sorry. Yeah. Well, that's from the Austin police report. If you look at what he pled guilty to, it looks like one count. And, you know, I suppose.
I understand he may have pled out to one count, but the question was what was he charged with?
That's a connection with the Sonic checks, and I don't really want to get into the minutiae of what he pled to, because there's so many different ways the pre-sentence report says it. I mean, usually when I see a pre-sentence report, they'll list all the counts in the complaint, state offense or federal offense. It'll say count one, count two, count three, and then it'll say pled to count one, and sometimes it says the others are dismissed, sometimes not. But here in paragraph 50, they only said pled guilty to forgery. It's the description of the Austin police reports. Maybe you could infer it was four. I will go that far. But again, that is a small number. And I'm sorry, I want to back up one more minute. The way I looked at that paragraph was I thought that embodied the Sonic check that he gave to Alex Bunton, because Alex Bunton actually did cash a check from a company called Ignite, a counterfeit check for a company called Ignite for Mr. Brooks. And then he had remorse for having done that, and he went to the police and told them that Mr. Brooks had gotten him to cash this check. So they, and he said, I kept his phone number so I could call him back. So he set Mr. Brooks up really with a sting, and when he showed up to Mr. Brooks presented him with a Sonic check. That's all you hear about the Sonic, that Sonic check in this record. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Ms. Fuentes, can you help me with the math here?
I'm
How many
trying.
Of these do you have to negate to not be sufficiently backed up in order to get your new sentencing?
Only the Relief Enterprises check. The entire amount the court found Mr. Brooks liable for was $94,828. And I may be a little off on a couple of dollars, but it's $94,000.
So you need to get it below 70.
Correct, below 70 to get him down two levels.
And so if you get the relief, it doesn't matter about
Correct.
The satellite and the Sonic
Correct.
Check ones. So you
Correct.
Really want the relief ones.
Yes. Well, the relief ones, to me, it seems, are the most attenuated. And I'll skip the Sonic, and I can go on to the other group of checks, unless
so
the court
has... So is it your contention that there's this band of different forgers running around using the same methodology as Mr. Brooks but unrelated to him? And that's your explanation for these Relief Enterprises checks?
It seems to me most likely that it is something analogous to one of the examples that's given in the application notes to the relevant conduct guideline. And that is, in a drug case, for example, you can have one drug dealer supplying drugs, but each of the people to whom he supplies those drugs is not responsible for all of the drugs by the entire group. And that's application note, I think it's B6.
But in that approach, you're saying Mr. Brooks is not the supplier, he's just one of the minions. And that wasn't my sense of this case. My sense was he was more the hub than the spoke.
I think the case changed over time, because when these first checks came up in 2009, including the Relief Enterprises checks, the police interviewed Mr. Brooks, and Mr. Brooks said that a man named Terrence Anderson was providing checks to him. And later, when they spoke with him, he said a new person was providing checks, a woman named Rosie. But I will say, by 2011, I don't think November 2010, but certainly by February and March of 2011, Mr. Brooks was running his own business. He had the check equipment, he was making the checks, and he was getting people to cash them.
So you're saying he was an apprentice in the Relief Enterprises time period and then became a master sorcerer later? Or?
I couldn't really say whether he's an apprentice.
Okay. I mean, that's your problem with the Relief Enterprises. If he is an orchestrator of this, then he is responsible for it. If he's just kind of the equivalent of a drug runner, then I would agree he's not necessarily responsible for everything everybody else does.
I think the evidence is very thin that he had, maybe non-existent, that he was producing those checks. I think a good example is when, admittedly, it was much later when the police searched his home in May of 2011, but they only found files for Phil's ice cream. And when he spoke with the police in November of 2010, at that time, he still was not manufacturing checks and handing them out. So that is our theory, not that I don't think that he was an apprentice, but that he was being supplied with checks, and probably with other people, again, if you look at the dates and how difficult it would be for one person to cash them. And for that reason, I find his situation analogous to the drug seller, many drug sellers who receive their drugs from a common source.
How did you counter the PSR's conclusions at the sentencing hearing or at any time in the record? How did you dispute those assertions? I would think he's the one that's possessed of all this information, and he's at sentencing. He's not talking about guilt or innocence. Does he offer evidence of contrary evidence, or does anybody offer any witnesses or anybody?
No, Your Honor. But our theory was and is.
You let the government prove it, but
our theory.
Yeah.
I understand. What we have argued is that the evidence in the pre-sentence reports cannot be accepted because it was just ball conclusory statements. They're only what this pre-sentence report calls two transactions set out. It's really the three checks that are the substantive counts of the indictment. And I think it is the Natasha Walker check. No, I take that
but
back.
But then we got the charts and the agent's testimony, though.
Yes, that is a different matter.
And that's...
That is a different matter altogether.
What is the record evidence of that, that they were these other operators doing the same, using the same methods and equipment, essentially?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I
what
didn't...
What is the evidence in the record of the other participants, that is, his competitors, who he implicitly is saying was the one that cashed these other checks?
I don't think there is affirmative evidence of that. What there is a lack of evidence that ties Mr. Brooks to those.
What I'm saying is there evidence that there were other people doing the same thing? Or it's just that the weakness, well, that they can't necessarily tie him directly to all these others. That's a big difference.
Yes, it is a big difference. And I think part of the answer to that is what I had mentioned before, and that is these checks are, for example, Sonic, all on one day. It just does not make any sense that he could have done that. He's also sometimes accompanied by another person, sometimes not. So we know there are other people in here.
Well, if the record doesn't show that there's really anybody else out there doing this. It's a rather extraordinary thing that you now have some grand mogul, Austin or wherever it is, that is generating the little kits, you know. Go and earn your own business. Just here's what you need. Here's the paper. Here's the equipment. Here's a list of payees. Here's all this stuff. There's no explanation for the tie and the fit of this information other than that. And there's no evidence of that. If you're stuck with that, then that's just the same modus operandi or whatever. That's enough to tie them together for sentencing.
Well, I don't think the same modus operandi is enough. And I don't know how much you want me to elaborate on that. I don't think that is enough. Sometimes that will suffice for common scheme or plan, which is a different way to impose liability. But even if you're trying to show a common scheme or plan, you still have to meet the requirements of the relevant conduct guideline, and that is...
Show that he was reasonably foreseeable.
Pardon?
They got to show that it's a record basis for concluding that it's more likely than not that he was a participant. Do you agree that's the standard? Is
yes.
It preponderance?
Yes, it is a preponderance.
It's more likely than not. We're not finding guilty of these. We're just saying it's more likely than not that because the same pattern and conduct, the same equipment was used, et cetera, and there's no evidence any other players in this thing, that he did at least that many transactions. Is that it?
I think there's some evidence of other players, and our position is that it was very different before 2011 and after.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have something else?
No.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Basically, this case revolves around relevant conduct and the application of 1B1.3. And what we're really talking about here is not the absence of linkages. It's whether the linkages we have are enough to support the district court's finding of the amount of loss. There are linkages in every one of these situations back to Mr. Brooks. It's easy for defense counsel to point out that maybe we couldn't prove in every certain circumstance that each individual payee or check casher was necessarily identified, because Mr. Brooks recruited homeless people. And our agent testified that it's very difficult to trace those individuals down. It's a very clever scheme. And so on the one hand, you could argue, well, how could you cash, 15 or 20 Sonic checks in a period of a few hours? But on the other hand, there are linkages in almost every circumstance from Mr. Brooks to the checks. For example, going back to the satellite healthcare, Natasha Walker, we have a cash check at an HEB. 3 months later, Isn't it interesting? He's found with three checks in his car parked in the HEB parking lot. There are linkages all over this scheme that link him to these checks, and that's what the district court found.
Can you please go to the Relief Enterprises check? Because it's my understanding he was not linked to any of these accomplices.
Well, I believe the testimony, and I'll have to go back to the page on Relief Enterprises.
And in fact, the agent said to do so would be pure guesswork.
Well, actually, that pure guesswork language, he's talking about where the actual payee cashers were. He said, I can't find them. And I think that that pure guesswork comment is a little bit taken out of context.
Okay, well then tell me how that he was linked to these cashers for the Relief Enterprises.
Okay, so he's asked, I noticed on the relief checks and the Sonic checks, I picked out 11 of the same individuals that cashed the Sonic checks, cashed the relief checks relatively within the last couple of days for each of the Sonic checks and the relief checks that were cashed. So it was 11 people that cashed both checks, so that led us to believe it was the same group. And that's on page 19 of the record, of the sentencing transcript.
Anything else to link him?
Well, actually, I think that in, as part of the overall scheme, I think that is what links him, is that
well,
we do have.
And the amounts were all in the 900s.
And the time frame.
Yeah.
And I think, and if you look at the checks themselves, there's a certain, in my opinion, consistency to the checks in the exhibits, and I invite the court
in
to look at them.
In what way? Because it's my understanding that these are copies and you can't tell about the level of paper, and that's really misleading to be relying upon the paper when these are all copies.
Well, I agree that when I looked at them and I looked at the exhibits, I thought they were similar in the amounts, the time frame, and the lack of other, in other words, what's absent even from the checks. They're very simple. They're used, you know, and what's interesting is that he's got this check creating software, and there's some idea that maybe he went from being a small-time player to a manufacturer over time. I'm not so sure that that's an inference that we necessarily know for sure, other than when they searched his home, they found check-creating software, and they found the instruments to make checks.
Right, but that wasn't linked to these relief. I'm trying to specifically link him to the relief. And so far, the only thing that we have, okay, we've got 11 of the same individuals also on the Sonic. Right.
Those are the linkages, yes.
And then...
And the same time frame.
And the same time frame, roughly same amounts, I believe.
I mean, like, Carrie Smith has a Sonic check on 7/18/2009 and then a Relief Enterprises check on July 20/2009, both in the 900s.
Mm-hmm. And those... And so...
As an example.
These are the sorts of things that ultimately, and I think that's what this court has to do, is decide whether under, as you point out, Judge Higginbotham, a preponderance of the evidence standard, and ultimately we come down to whether this was an abuse of discretion, really, is whether this court is in a position to view Judge Sparks's findings as basically, is it enough? And that's a hard case to deal with. I would like to point out that in reading over the transcript again last night, if you look at the sentencing transcript, it appears that, and I'm sorry that neither either brief really mentions the sentence imposed, but in this case there was an upward variance. And if you look on page 40 of the sentencing transcript, Judge Sparks says, after looking through there, after I got through reading it, and he's referring to the PSR, I didn't think this was a guidelines case anyway. And then two pages later, he says, all right, Mr. Brooks, well, considering the nature and circumstances of the offense and your characteristics in history, as I have indicated, you've been a thief for a long time using aliases, birth dates. He goes through, and then he says, when I think of the elements of 3553A and on the need to reflect the seriousness of the offense and to provide adequate deterrence to protect the public, it appears to me, and I sentence you to a term of 84 months. So the court ultimately, it seems to me, has an alternative basis here, and in May
he doesn't say he is doing a variance. He says he's considering a variance.
I think right, well, on page 43,
well, what was the guidelines range?
Ultimately, that's above the guidelines range,
yeah,
I think.
It's what?
I believe it's an upward variance.
Okay, so this is a new argument that you're making?
I'm just saying that the record, I noticed this in reading the record,
okay,
that it does reflect that Judge Sparks did make these remarks.
Okay, but my question to you was, has to do with, you didn't really refute the harmless error, the Ibarra-Luna, you didn't really refute that in the briefing. And now you're saying, well, this would be harmless because it was an upward variance and he has all... Today, it's a brand new argument. Isn't that right? Are you making that argument or are you not asking us to rely on that?
I'm just pointing out to the court that in looking at the sentencing transcript...
Well, you wouldn't be pointing it out if you weren't making a new argument today, would you, sir?
I'm basically, in looking at it, after in the sum of the whole argument, and I don't disagree with you at all, Judge Elrod, that neither party addressed this. But it occurred to me in reading through the transcript last night and in preparation for this case that, there is something here that is a little bit interesting. And I think that ultimately what this comes down to is whether this court is going to second-guess Judge Sparks's findings and whether, and there are linkages, whether this court simply finds those linkages are insufficient to establish that these acts were foreseeable and within the scope of the agreement to which he pleaded guilty, or whether they were sufficient. And admittedly, I think this is a difficult case in the fact that many of the check cashers, by nature of the scheme, were difficult for the agent to locate because they're homeless people who simply cannot be found.
I take it after the arrest of this man that the agents, that the check cashing episodes in the area ended.
That is not in the record, Your Honor. It's clear that he truly is a one-man crime spree. He is engaged in this. He basically has an enterprise, and it's very, very clever and successful. It took a lot of effort.
What does the record show us about whether there were more operators than this defendant at the time?
It really is unclear. I think it's speculation to say that there are more operators. It's obvious that lots and lots of people are involved in the cashing of the checks. Yeah. Now,
those are the homeless recruiting issue. Okay.
Exactly. He produces...
Was there a Terry Anderson or a Rosie, or did those people exist?
Oh, I believe they did. I believe okay. that the evidence
you just
is...
make them up.
Yeah. He went to... Okay. He actually only recruited people that he knew had a driver's license...
No. I mean, she mentioned that basically the people he learned from were Terry Anderson and Rosie. That's who I'm not asking about the homeless people.
Oh, I see.
I'm asking about, her argument is sort of that he was the apprentice for a time and that he learned at the feet of Terry Anderson and Rosie. And my question is, did those people actually exist or did he just make them up?
That I'm not sure the record is clear about, to tell you, in honesty, I don't know for sure.
And on the upward variance point, Mr. Brooks himself notes that it's an upward variance and then argues it's not harmless error because you're supposed to calculate the guidelines correctly and consider that even when there's an upward variance. So that argument has been made in the opposite, not by you.
And quite frankly, this court has consistently applied and said that we start with a properly calculated guideline range. And unless it's completely unrelated to, and this court's jurisprudence seems to be somewhat all over the place in all candor in terms of whether in this.
When we see it.
And I think this is a case that clearly, though, this isn't a case where there's just an absence of linkages. It's a question of whether those linkages are sufficient.
But under our majority precedent, if we do have all over the place, if it's incorrect, the guidelines are incorrect, and you didn't demonstrate harmlessness, we have to remand for resentencing, correct?
Unless, and you show that the district court did not rely on the incorrectly calculated range in reaching the sentence, and in this case...
But that's not true. You have to first start with the correct guideline anyway.
I believe in looking at some of the authorities that there is language that suggests that if there is an improperly calculated range, but under 3553, there are no linkages to the improperly calculated range. In this case, it really does appear to me, at least, that he's assessing this based on the criminal history.
Well, that's a brand new argument today. That is not.
Well, I'm reading through the record and pointing it out, and I think it was undisputed it was an upward variance. And so the question then is, at the end of the day, will Judge Sparks ultimately impose the same sentence on remand, or whether he would choose a different sentence? And the way I read it, it seems
that's not the question. We don't look at what he would do on remand. We look at whether he made this sentence under an alternative basis.
I'm just saying that under an alternative sentencing theory, it's whether the likelihood that the court intended to impose that
right.
sentence.
But it doesn't have to do with on
not
remand.
The remand, but ultimately.
Okay, but do you think you can win on what you actually argued?
I do.
Okay.
Absolutely. And I think that that's the question, is whether the linkages between the various checks and the payees and Mr. Brooks are sufficient, or whether this court finds that they're insufficient. There are, and the difference, I just want to point out, this isn't a case where there are no linkages. This is a case where there are linkages. It's just a question of whether this court feels they're adequate to meet the requirements of 1B1.3.
Thank you.
I just have a couple of points. I found the satellite health care checks that were in Mr. Brooks's car in November. They're outlined in the indictment at page 44 of the record, and that, I think, is the only place their numbers appear, and they are not in sequence with the other ones. The ones that are listed on page 8 of the government spreadsheet are 6865 and 6863. The satellite health care checks that are outlined on page 44 of the record are 47322, 47323, and 47324. So they're in sequence, the ones that were found in November, but they're not in sequence with the ones that were found earlier in August. I have to disagree with the government about the guesswork comment, and I want to read the question that preceded the answer, because maybe you could read it the way the government said, but my view is you read it that way, taking it out of context. Here's in context at page 162 of the record. Question by defense counsel. So as far as the group of people, though, back on the checks, for instance, in 2010 or 2009, there's nobody that's made either a statement to you or a statement to APD other than Alex Button. Is that correct? Answer, that is correct. Now comes the next question. So as far as these folks and their situation, where they might be, that's pure guesswork. So it's both things
that
he's
referring
to.
That's where they might be. They're homeless people. I respectfully think you are taking it out of context. It certainly doesn't show that he's saying that whether they have a connection to Mr. Brooks is pure guesswork. It's a question of where are it, because the argument is, why have you not brought these people in to say, I met Mr. Brooks, and it's because I can't find him.
I read it as the evidence pertaining to those checks is pure guesswork, and the link. So that's a disagreement. I think if you read the first question, that's what it says.
Let me ask you a question about the certainly. Earlier your response to the regard to the sequential ordering of the check. As I read Government Exhibit 1 and the spreadsheet, 97 checks were drawn on business accounts in batches, and with each batch, the checks numbered in roughly sequential order. Is that correct?
That is probably correct for most of the checks. And again, I'm sorry to take your time up, but just let me take a. It's a long chart. It's hard to keep all the numbers in order. 90, let's see. The Relief Enterprises, for example, 93, 94, 97. That's 8997, 9002. They're all in the ballpark. They're in the ballpark. I can't say that they're exactly sequential, but they're not so far outlying as the satellite healthcare checks are.
But then they all were in amounts between $700 and $1,000? That's what
I'd say many of them are.
But shows. I don't know.
Many of them are. 800, 900, 900, 800, 900. I'd say that's more or less correct. There are some for 700 that we know that are a lower amount, the ones that we know that Mr. Brooks did, the Phil's Ice House and Amy's Ice Cream, and the one that we know he passed with Mr. Bunton, the Ignite check was for $2,200. So there are some outliers, but there is some similarity. I can't say there isn't.
And we know that all 97 checks came from the same check stock.
No, that we do not know. I vehemently disagree with that. And in the reply brief, I outlined, and I think the government suggested that those are similarities.
Yeah, page 19 of the brief, they suggested it.
But haven't they backed off?
What's wrong with it?
I'm sorry. Here's my view on that. I attached to the reply brief copies of, just for examples, four checks. Mm-hmm. To the extent you can tell anything about the check stock, and my personal view is you can't tell anything from Xerox copies, and nobody has any original check stock. The government didn't see it. I didn't see it. I went crazy looking for it. I couldn't find any original check stock. And so to the extent you can tell anything, there are differences, not similarities, and that's laid out very specifically in our reply brief with examples in the appendix to the reply brief.
Well, in fact, the government backed off of that when I asked the government about that earlier. They are not relying on the check stock argument. The government's nodding its head that I've got that correct.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, we just don't have any evidence on that, or they were from different check stock?
There's, you can't tell anything about the check stock.
We just don't know.
Right.
Okay.
If there are no other questions, my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This case is submitted.